of any company. It's an essential component of economic life. We should only mourn and be concerned about the fate of the people who often suffer when companies disappear, whether they are the workers, management, or even the owners. If only we could tame the potential brutality and greed of the survival of the fittest, and soften some of its more egregious consequences by formulating a magic algorithm for how to balance the classic tension between regulation, government intervention, and uncontrolled, rampant capitalism. This struggle painfully played itself out as we witnessed the struggle between the death throes of corporations that probably should have died, and the desire to save jobs and protect the lives of workers, because certain incompetent, if not duplicitous, corporations were deemed too big to fail during the 2008 financial crisis. It may be a platitude, but it's nevertheless true that nothing stays the same. Both Standard & Poor's and the business magazine Fortune construct ongoing lists of the 500 most successful companies, and there is a certain prestige associated with being named on both of these lists. Richard Foster, who was for 22 years a director and senior partner of the well-known business consultants McKinsey & Company, analyzed the tenure of companies on these lists and discovered that it has been regularly decreasing over the past 60 years. For example, he found that in 1958, a company could expect to stay on the S&P 500 for about 61 years, whereas today it's more like 18. Of the Fortune 500 companies in 1955, only 61 were still on the list in 2014. That's only a 12% survival rate, the other 88% having gone bankrupt, merged, or fallen from the list because of underperformance. More poignant, perhaps, is that most of those on the list in 1955 are unrecognizable and completely forgotten today. How many remember Armstrong Rubber or Pacific Vegetable Oil? In 2000, Foster wrote an influential bestseller on business, aptly titled Creative Destruction. He was much taken by the ideas on complexity being developed at the Santa Fe Institute, so much so that he joined the Board of Trustees and persuaded McKinsey to fund a professorship in finance, which was held by Doyne Farmer. I got to know him when I first engaged with SFI in the late 1990s. He was convinced that the scaling and network ideas that we have been developing in biology could provide major insights into how companies function. He pointed out that there were no quantitative mechanistic theories of companies, and that because they are very often compared to organisms, this approach might provide a novel way of developing such a theory. He generously offered to give me access to the large McKinsey database on companies and to help support a postdoc to carry out the research. I was still at Los Alamos at the time, engaged with running high-energy physics, and knew even less about companies than I do now. Furthermore, the research in biology was still at quite an early stage, and I was not convinced that it could readily be extended to companies. So, despite being flattered by the offer, I did not pursue it. In retrospect, that was probably the right decision at the time, but it speaks volumes about Dick Foster that he had the foresight to see that the scaling approach might provide a useful basis for understanding companies. It took more than a decade of extensive work on organisms, ecosystems, and cities before we were in a position to address Dick's challenge. Unfortunately, it's not a straightforward exercise to relate the observations regarding the tenure of companies on the S&P and Fortune 500 lists to their actual lifespans without a detailed analysis that takes into account their age and whether or not they died. Nevertheless, the findings dramatically illustrate the fragility of seemingly powerful companies and are also a striking example of the speeding up of socio-economic life. The survival analyses tell us that there should be very few old companies. An extrapolation of the theory and data predicts that the probability of a company's lasting for 100 years is only about 45 in a million, and for it to last 200 years, it's a minuscule 1 in a billion. These numbers should not be taken too seriously, but they do give us a sense of the scale of long-term survivability, and provide an interesting insight into the characteristics of companies that have remained viable for hundreds of years. There are at least 100 million companies in the world, so if they all obey similar dynamics, then one would expect only about 4,500 to survive for 100 years, but none for 200. However, it is well known that there are lots of companies, especially in Japan and Europe, that have lived for hundreds of years. Unfortunately, there are no comprehensible data sets or any systematic statistical analyses of these remarkable outliers, though there are plenty of anecdotal stories. Nevertheless, we can learn something instructive about the aging of companies from the general characteristics of these very long-lived outliers. Most of them are of relatively modest size, operating in highly specialized niche markets, such as ancient inns, wineries, breweries, confectioners, restaurants, and the like. These have quite a different character from the kinds of companies we have been considering in the CompuStat dataset and the S&P and Fortune 500 lists. In contrast to most of these outliers have survived not by diversifying or innovating, but by continuing to produce a perceived high-quality product for a small, dedicated clientele. Many have maintained their viability through reputation and consistency, and have barely grown. Interestingly, most of them are Japanese. According to the Bank of Korea, of the 5,586 companies that were more than 200 years old in 2008, over half, 3,146 to be precise, were Japanese, 837 German, 222 Dutch, and 196 French. Furthermore, 90% of those that were more than 100 years old had fewer than 300 employees. There are some wonderful examples of these geriatric survivors. For instance, the oldest shoemaker in Germany is the Eduard Meyer Company, founded in Munich in 1596, which became purveyors to the Bavarian aristocracy. It still has only a single store that sells, though no longer makes, quality upscale shoes. The oldest hotel in the world, according to Guinness World Records, is Nishiyama Onsen Kyunkan in Hayakawa, Japan, which was founded in 705. It has been in the same family for 52 generations, and even in its modern incarnation has only 37 rooms. Its main attraction seems to be its hot springs. The world's oldest company was purported to be Kongo Gumi, founded in Osaka, Japan, in 578. It was also a family business, going back many generations, but after almost 1,500 years of continuously being in business, it went into liquidation in 2006, and was purchased by the Takamatsu Corporation. And what was the niche market that Kongo Gumi cornered for 1,429 years? Building beautiful Buddhist temples. But sadly, with the changes in Japanese culture following the Second World War, the demand for temples dried up, and Kongo Gumi was unable to adapt fast enough. 5. Why companies die, but cities don't. The power of scaling is that it can potentially reveal the underlying principles that determine the dominant behavior of highly complex systems. For organisms and cities, this fruitfully led to a network-based theory for quantitatively understanding the principal features of their dynamics and structure, from which many of their salient properties could be understood. In both cases, we know quite a bit about their network structures, whether they are circulatory systems, road networks, or social systems. On the other hand, despite an extensive literature on the subject, we know much less about the network structures of companies other than that they are, for the most part, hierarchical. Standard company organizational charts are typically top-down, having a tree-like structure superficially suggestive of a classic self-similar fractal. That would explain why companies manifest power law scaling. Unfortunately, however, we don't have extensive quantitative data on these organizational networks comparable to what we have for cities and organisms. For instance, we don't typically know how many people are functioning at each level, how much of the company's finances and resources are flowing between them, and how much information they are exchanging. And even if some of this were available, we need to have it across the entire size range of companies. Furthermore, it is not at all clear that the official organizational charts of companies represents the actuality of what the real operational network structures are. Who is really communicating with whom? How often are they doing it? How much do they exchange? And so on. What is really needed is access to all of the company's communication channels, such as the phone calls, the emails, the meetings, etc., quantified analogously to the cell phone data we used for helping to develop a science of cities. It's unlikely such comprehensive data exist, and even less likely that we would ever gain ready access to them. Companies are quite wary of exposing themselves to outside investigators unless they are paying them exorbitant consultant fees, presumably so that they can maintain control. But if you want to understand how a company really functions, or want to develop a serious science of companies, then this is the kind of data that is ultimately needed. Consequently, we don't have a well-developed mechanistic framework analogous to the network-based theory for organisms, and to a lesser extent cities, for analytically understanding the dynamics and structures of companies, and in particular, for calculating the values of their exponents. Nevertheless, just as we have been able to construct a theory of their growth trajectories, we can address the question of their mortality by extrapolating from what we have already learned. I emphasized earlier that most companies operate close to a critical point where sales and expenses are finely balanced, making them potentially vulnerable to fluctuations and perturbations. A major shock at the wrong time can lead to their demise. Younger companies, which are buffered against this by an initial capital endowment, become particularly vulnerable once this initial infusion is expended, if they are unable to turn a significant profit. This is sometimes referred to as the liability of adolescence. The fact that companies scale sublinearly rather than superlinearly like cities suggests that they epitomize the triumph of economies of scale over innovation and idea creation. Companies typically operate as highly constrained top-down organizations that strive to increase efficiency of production and minimize operational costs so as to maximize profits. In contrast, cities embody the triumph of innovation over the hegemony of economies of scale. Cities aren't, of course, driven by a profit motive and have the luxury of being able to balance their books by raising taxes. They operate in a much more distributed fashion, with power spread across multiple organizational structures, from mayors and councils to businesses and citizen action groups. No single group has absolute control. As such, they exude an almost laissez-faire, freewheeling ambience relative to companies, taking advantage of the innovative benefits of social interactions, whether good, bad, or ugly. Despite their apparent bumbling inefficiencies, cities are places of action and agents of change relative to companies, which, by and large, usually project an image of stasis, unless they are young. To achieve greater efficiency in the pursuit of greater market share and increased profits, companies stereotypically add more rules, regulations, protocols, and procedures at increasingly finer levels of organization, resulting in the increased bureaucratic control that is typically needed to administer, manage, and oversee their execution. This is often accomplished at the expense of innovation and R&D, research and development, which should be major components of a company's insurance policy for its long-term future and survivability. It's difficult to obtain meaningful data on innovation in companies because it's not straightforward to quantify. Innovation is not necessarily synonymous with R&D, especially as there are significant tax advantages in labeling all sorts of extraneous activities as R&D expenses. Nevertheless, from analyzing the CompuStat dataset, we found that the relative amount allocated to R&D systematically decreases as company size increases, suggesting that support for innovation does not keep up with bureaucratic and administrative expenses as companies expand. The increasing accumulation of rules and constraints is often accompanied by stagnating relationships with consumers and suppliers that lead companies to become less agile and more rigid, and therefore less able to respond to significant change. In cities, we saw that one very important hallmark is that they become ever more diverse as they grow. Their spectrum of business and economic activity is incessantly expanding as new sectors develop and new opportunities present themselves. In this sense, cities are prototypically multidimensional, and this is strongly correlated with their superlinear scaling, open-ended growth, and expanding social networks, and a crucial component of their resilience, sustainability, and seeming immortality. While the dimensionality of cities is continually expanding, the dimensionality of companies typically contracts from birth through adolescence, eventually stagnating or even further contracting as they mature and move into old age. When still young and competing for a place in the market, there is a youthful excitement and enthusiasm as new products are developed and ideas bubble up. Some may be crazy and unrealistic, and some grandiose and visionary. But market forces are at work so that only a few of these are successful as the company gains a foothold and an identity. As it grows, the feedback mechanisms inherent in the market lead to a narrowing of its product space and inevitably to greater specialization. The great challenge for companies is how to balance the positive feedback from market forces, which strongly encourage staying with tried and true products, versus the long-term strategic need to develop new areas and commodities that may be risky and won't give immediate return. Most companies tend to be short-sighted, conservative, and not very supportive of innovative or risky ideas, happy to stay almost entirely with their major successes while the going is good, because these guarantee short-term returns. Consequently, they tend toward becoming more and more unidimensional. This reduction in diversity, coupled with the predicament described earlier, in which companies sit near a critical point, is a classic indicator of reduced resilience and a recipe for eventual disaster. By the time a company realizes its condition, it is often too late. Reconfiguring and reinventing become increasingly difficult and expensive. So, when a large enough unanticipated fluctuation, perturbation, or shock comes along, the company becomes seriously at risk and ripe for a takeover, buyout, or simply going belly up. In a word, it is, as the mafiosi put it, il bacio della morte, the kiss of death. Chapter 10. The Vision of a Grand Unified Theory of Sustainability. In this final chapter, I want to bring together some of the threads that have been developed throughout the book and weave them into a tapestry that I hope will stimulate deeper thinking and speculation about the future of the extraordinary, exponentially expanding socio-economic universe that we have created. One of the major challenges of the 21st century that will have to be faced is the fundamental question as to whether human-engineered social systems, from economies to cities, which have only existed for the past 5,000 years or so, can continue to coexist with the natural, biological world from which they emerged, and which has been around for several billion years. To sustain more than 10 billion people living in harmony with the biosphere at a standard of living and quality of life comparable to what we now have, requires that we develop a deep understanding of the principles and underlying system dynamics of this social-environmental coupling. I have argued that a critical component of this is to develop a deeper understanding of cities and urbanization. Continuing to pursue limited and single-system approaches to the many problems we face without developing a unified framework risks the possibility that we will squander huge financial and social capital and fail miserably in addressing the really big question, resulting in dire consequences. Existing strategies have, to a large extent, failed to come to terms with an essential feature of the long-term sustainability challenge embodied in the paradigm of complex adaptive systems, namely, the pervasive interconnectedness and interdependency of energy, resources, and environmental, ecological, economic, social, and political systems. One of the most important results to emerge from the work I discussed in chapters 7 and 8 is that all socio-economic activity, from innovation and wealth creation to crime and disease, whether good, bad, or ugly, is quantitatively interrelated, as manifested in the universality of scaling laws. Almost all existing approaches to the challenge of global sustainability focus on relatively specific issues, such as the environmental consequences of future energy sources, the economic consequences of climate change, and the social impact of future energy and environmental choices. While such focused studies are of obvious importance and where most of our research efforts should be directed, they are not sufficient. They focus primarily on the trees and risk missing the forest. It's time to recognize that a broad, multidisciplinary, multi-institutional, multinational initiative, guided by a broader, more integrated and unified perspective, should be playing a central role in guiding our scientific agenda in addressing this issue and informing policy. We need a broad and more integrated scientific framework that encompasses a quantitative, predictive, mechanistic theory for understanding the relationship between human-engineered systems, both social and physical, and the natural environment. A framework I call a grand unified theory of sustainability. It's time to initiate a massive international Manhattan-style project, or Apollo-style program, dedicated to addressing global sustainability in an integrated, systemic sense. Accelerating treadmills, cycles of innovation, and finite time singularities. In biology, the network principles underlying economies of scale and sublinear scaling have two profound consequences. They constrain the pace of life. Big animals live longer, evolve more slowly, and have slower heart rates, all to the same degree, and limit growth. In contrast, cities and economies are driven by social interactions whose feedback mechanisms lead to the opposite behavior. The pace of life systematically increases with population size. Diseases spread faster, businesses are born and die more often, and people even walk faster in larger cities, all by approximately the same 15% rule. Moreover, the social network dynamic underlying superlinear scaling leads to open-ended growth, which is the primary assumption upon which modern cities and economies are based. Continuous adaptation, not equilibrium, is the rule. This is a wonderfully consistent picture. The same conceptual framework based on underlying network dynamics and geometry, with the same mathematical structure, leads to quite different outcomes in these two very different cases, and both are strongly supported by a plethora of diverse data and observations. However, there is a big catch with potentially huge consequences. Even though the growth of organisms, cities, and economies follows essentially identical mathematical equations, their resulting solutions have subtle but crucial differences, arising from one being driven by sublinear scaling, the economies of scale of organisms, and the other by superlinear scaling, the increasing returns to scale of cities and economies. In the superlinear case, their general solution exhibits an unexpectedly curious property, technically known as a finite-time singularity, which is a signal of inevitable change and possibly of potential trouble ahead. A finite-time singularity simply means that the mathematical solution to the growth equation governing whatever is being considered, the population, the GDP, the number of patents, etc., becomes infinitely large at some finite time. This is obviously impossible, and that's why something has to change. Before addressing some of the consequences of this phenomenon, let me first elaborate on some of its salient features. Simple power laws and exponentials are continuously increasing functions that also eventually become infinitely large, but they take an infinite time to do so. Another way of saying this is that in these cases, the singularity has been pushed off to an infinite time into the future, thereby rendering it harmless relative to the potential impact of a finite time singularity. In the case of growth driven by superlinear scaling, the approach to the finite time singularity is faster than exponential. This is often referred to as super-exponential, a term I've already used earlier when discussing the growth of cities. This kind of growth behavior is clearly unsustainable because it requires an unlimited, ever-increasing, and eventually infinite supply of energy and resources at some finite time in the future in order to maintain it. Left unchecked, the theory predicts that it triggers a transition to a phase that leads to stagnation and eventual collapse. This scenario sounds just like a rehash of the standard Malthusian argument that has been summarily dismissed by generations of economists, namely that we won't be able to keep up with demand and that open-ended growth will eventually lead to catastrophe. Which brings us to the crux of the matter. Because of the presence of a finite time singularity resulting from superlinear scaling, this scenario is categorically different from that of Malthus. If growth were purely exponential, as assumed by Malthusians, neo-Malthusians, their followers, and critics, then the production of energy, resources, and food could, at least in principle, keep up with exponential expansion, because all of the relevant characteristics of the economy or city remain finite, even if they continue to increase in size and become very large. This cannot be achieved if you are growing super-exponentially and approaching a finite-time singularity. In this scenario, demand gets progressively larger and larger, eventually becoming infinite within a finite period of time. It is simply not possible to supply an infinite amount of energy, resources, and food in a finite time. So, if nothing else changes, this inextricably leads to stagnation and collapse. An extensive analysis carried out in 2001 by Didier Sonnet and Anders Johansson, then at UCLA, showed that data on population growth and the growth of financial and economic indicators strongly support the theoretical predictions that we have been growing super exponentially and are indeed headed toward such a singularity. I want to emphasize that this situation is qualitatively quite different from classic Malthusian dynamics, where this is no such singularity. The existence of a singularity signifies that there has to be a transition from one phase of the system to another, having very different characteristics, analogous to the way the condensation of steam to water, which subsequently freezes to ice, epitomizes transitions between different phases of the same system, each having quite different physical properties. And indeed, underlying such familiar phase transitions are singularities in the thermodynamic variables characterizing the system, water, but in terms of temperature rather than time, 0 degrees centigrade for freezing and 100 degrees centigrade for boiling. Unfortunately, for cities and socio-economic systems, the phase transition stimulated by the finite time singularity is from super-exponential growth to stagnation and collapse, and this could lead to potentially devastating consequences. So, how can such a collapse be avoided, and can it be achieved while still ensuring open-ended growth? The first point to appreciate is that these predictions assume that the parameters of the growth equation do not change. So, one clear strategy for forestalling a potential catastrophe is to intervene before reaching the singularity by resetting the parameters. Moreover, to maintain open-ended growth with these new settings requires that the driving term in the equation, the social metabolism, needs to remain superlinear, meaning that the new dynamic must still be driven by the positive feedback forces of social interaction responsible for innovation and for wealth and knowledge creation. Such an intervention is none other than what is usually referred to as an innovation. A major innovation effectively resets the clock by changing the conditions under which the system has been operating and growth occurring. Thus, to avoid collapse, a new innovation must be initiated that resets the clock, allowing growth to continue and the impending singularity to be avoided. Major innovations can therefore be viewed as mechanisms for ensuring a soft transition to a new phase by circumnavigating the potentially disastrous discontinuity inherent in the black hole of a finite time singularity. Having made the transition and reset the clock to avoid stagnation and collapse, the process begins all over again with the continuation of super-exponential growth, eventually leading to a new finite time singularity, which likewise has to be circumvented. The entire sequence is continually repeated, thereby pushing potential collapse as far into the future as the creativity, inventiveness, and resourcefulness of human beings allow. This can be restated as a sort of theorem. To sustain open-ended growth in light of resource limitation requires continuous cycles of paradigm-shifting innovations. In actuality, the breaks between consecutive phases are not sharp and discontinuous, but are smeared out over relatively short periods of time around each transition. After all, the Industrial Revolution didn't begin on a specific day or even in a specific year, but emerged over a period of a few years around 1800, which is relatively small compared with the timescales of its influence. This result shouldn't come as any great surprise, because this is how continued, open-ended growth in both the population and socio-economic activity has been sustained. On the grand scale, the discoveries of iron, steam, coal, computation, and, most recently, digital information technology are among the major innovations that have fueled our continued growth and expansion. Indeed, the litany of such discoveries is a testament to our extraordinary ingenuity. It was this essential feature that was missing in Malthus's original argument, as well as in the subsequent arguments of most of its modern and more recent protagonists, beginning with Paul Ehrlich and the Club of Rome in the 1970s. Their admonitions were dismissed by most economists, primarily because they ignored the crucial role of innovation. The concept of business and economic cycles, and of implied cycles of innovation, has been around for a long time, and is now standard rhetoric in economics and the business community, even though it is primarily based on broad phenomenological deductions with little fundamental theory or mechanistic understanding. It is implicitly taken for granted, and often taken as unquestioned dogma, that as long as human beings remain inventive, we will stay ahead of any impending threat by continuous and ever more ingenious innovations. Unfortunately, however, it's not quite as simple as that. There's yet another major catch, and it's a big one. The theory dictates that to sustain continuous growth, the time between successive innovations has to get shorter and shorter. Thus, paradigm-shifting discoveries, adaptations, and innovations must occur at an increasingly accelerated pace. Not only does the general pace of life inevitably quicken, but we must innovate at a faster and faster rate. In addition to the pace of life accelerating as we climb up each growth curve, we have to make major innovations and transition to a new state at an increasingly accelerated rate. The treadmill metaphor I used earlier in both chapters 1 and 8 when explaining the contraction of socio-economic time and the increasing pace of life told only part of the story, and it's worth expanding upon it here. We're not only living on an accelerating treadmill that's always getting faster and faster, but at some stage, we have to jump onto another treadmill that is accelerating even faster, and sooner or later have to jump from that one onto yet another one that's going even faster. And this entire process has to be continually repeated into the future at a faster and faster rate. This is an extraordinary image, and sounds like some bizarre psychotic behavior. It's hard to believe that it can be sustained without our having a collective heart attack. It almost makes Sisyphus's task seem pretty mild. You may recall that the gods had condemned Sisyphus to ceaselessly push a huge rock up to the top of a mountain, from which it would immediately roll back down under its own weight, only for him to have to start all over again from the bottom. Many reasons have been advanced for why Sisyphus was being so severely punished, but the two I like best that relate to the Sisyphean task we have created for ourselves are that he had stolen the secrets of the gods and had put death in chains. No more need be said other than to recognize that our task is actually much harder than Sisyphus's, because we have to push the rock back up to the top of the mountain at a faster rate each time. These successive accelerating cycles of faster than exponential growth, predicted by the theory, are consistent with observations for cities, waves of technological change, and the world population. I have already referred to the work of Sornet and Johansson. As a specific example, consider the growth curve of New York City from 1790 to the present. By looking at how various successive phases of its growth deviate relative to the dominant background of pure super-exponential growth, the sequence of changes reflecting cyclic dynamics at the urban scale is clearly revealed. The data support the idea of cycles whose frequency systematically increases with time. The time between these successive innovations gets progressively shorter, consistent with the quantitative prediction from theory. On a grander scale, the prediction of accelerating cycles of major innovations is also strongly supported by data. One of the issues here is deciding which of the enormous number of possible innovations constitute major paradigm shifts. To some extent, this is in the eyes of the beholder, but it's likely that most of us would agree that certain discoveries and innovations, such as printing, coal, the telephone, and computers, constitute a major paradigm shift, whereas railways and cell phones may be more debatable. Unfortunately, there is no established quantitative science of innovation, and therefore no universally agreed-upon criteria or data relating directly to major innovations and paradigm shifts, let alone to finite time singularities. So in order to confront theory with data, we have to rely on informal studies and a certain degree of intuition. This situation may well change as innovation becomes an increasingly active area of investigation, with researchers beginning to grapple with questions such as, what is innovation? How do we measure it? How does it happen? And how can it be facilitated? The well-known inventor and futurist, Ray Kurzweil, has compiled and analyzed a list of his candidates for major innovations in a form that is highly suitable for comparison with our predictions. He has graphed the time between successive innovations against how long ago each innovation happened. Two versions are presented. One, semi-logarithmic, meaning that the vertical axis is logarithmic while the horizontal one is linear, and the other logarithmic for both axes. This tells us that life began about 4 times 10 to the 9th, 4 billion years ago, and that it took almost another 2 billion years before the next major innovation happened. It's interesting to note that when viewed on the linear timescale, everything appears to happen at the same time following the appearance of our earliest ancestors a million or so years ago. His graph curve falls precipitously, dramatically illustrating the acceleration of time. This graph also shows again why plotting such data logarithmically is so much more illuminating in separating different events taking place over such vast timescales. For instance, plotted this way, the appearance of the telephone just 100 years ago can be temporally separated from the appearance of agriculture 10,000 years ago. The theory explains and predicts this inverse relationship between the successive shortening of the time between innovations and how long ago they happened, and is quantitatively consistent with the lines drawn on both graphs. I hasten to add, however, that the predictions pertain only to the part of these graphs where innovation is due to socio-economic dynamics that engender human ingenuity. The theory makes no prediction about the rate of biological innovations. This leaves open the intriguing question as to whether an analogous singularity dynamic has played a similar role in driving biological innovation, or whether the agreement and the simple power law relationship that extends into this very early pre-human time period is just an accident or a result of Kurzweil's judicious choice of paradigm shifts. In any case, the agreement with theory where it applies is compelling and is supported by more detailed analysis confined to just the past few 100 years. The general concept of a singularity plays an important role in mathematics and theoretical physics. A singularity is a point at which a mathematical function is no longer well-behaved in some specific way, such as becoming infinite in the manner I have been discussing. Defining how to tame such singularities stimulated enormous progress in 19th century mathematics, and this subsequently had a huge impact on theoretical physics. Its most famous popular consequence was the concept of black holes, which arose from trying to understand the singularity structure of Einstein's theory of general relativity. Until it was popularized by Kurzweil in his 2005 book, The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, singularity was a term that was hardly used colloquially. Building on an earlier idea of a technological singularity, introduced in 1993 by the science fiction writer and computer scientist Werner Vinge, Kurzweil proposed that we are approaching a singularity in which our bodies and brains will be augmented by genetic alterations, nanotechnology, and artificial intelligence, to become hybrid cyborgs no longer bound by the constraints of biology. It was suggested that this would result in a collective intelligence that will be enormously more powerful than all present human intelligence combined. Or, as Vinge so succinctly put it, within 30 years we will have the technological means to create superhuman intelligence. Shortly after, the human era will be ended. This was written in 1993, so the prediction was that this will come to pass by 2023, which is now just 7 years hence. I don't think so. These are fascinating speculations which may well eventually come to pass, but are presently in the realm of science fiction. This Pollyanna vision for the future is almost diametrically opposite to the dire predictions of the Neo-Malthusians, even though the conclusions in both cases are, ironically, based on the same premise, that exponential growth is not sustainable as is, and that something dramatic has to happen. Just as the Malthusians ignored the crucial role of innovation, the singularity enthusiasts ignore the crucial role of the entire socio-economic dynamic of the planet, which in fact is the prime driver of the impending singularity. Neither case is anchored in a broader framework that embraces a quantitative mechanistic theory, so whatever their predictions are, it's very hard to evaluate them scientifically. Perhaps the greatest conceptual irony, especially of the singularists, is that their conclusions and speculations are based on exponential growth, which doesn't actually lead to a singularity, at least not in a finite time. Nevertheless, exponential growth may very well be unsustainable for the very kind of concrete reasons originally advanced by Malthus, namely that we will be unable to produce enough food or sufficient energy, or that we will run out of essential resources such as phosphorus, oil, or titanium, and that, at the same time, we will have failed to develop the appropriate technology to address these issues. In addition, we may be producing so much entropy that the resulting pollution, environmental damage, and other induced changes, particularly to the climate, become insurmountable, leading to untold, unintended, devastating consequences. However, I remind you that if this is the result of exponential growth, then there's nothing, in principle, hindering us from accomplishing what the optimists proclaim, and continuing to grow by dint of innovating ourselves out of all of these multiple problems and threats. But in practice, this could be a very different story, and I am not at all optimistic that it could be achieved. But this is not the situation. The actuality is qualitatively quite different. As I emphasized earlier, we have been expanding at a super exponential rate rather than just exponentially. And this has been driven by the superlinear scaling of socio-economic activity as a result of the multiplicative enhancement inherent in our social dynamics. This quintessential modern human dynamic has led to the speeding up of the pace of life and of the rate at which we have to make major innovations in order to combat the imminent threat of what finite time singularities portend. The image of an accelerating Sisyphus haunts us. The time between the computer age and the information and digital age was no more than about 30 years, to be compared with the thousands of years between the stone, bronze, and iron ages. The clock by which we measure time on our watches and digital devices is very misleading. It is determined by the daily rotation of the Earth around its axis and its annual rotation around the Sun. This astronomical time is linear and regular. But the actual clock, by which we live our socio-economic lives, is an emergent phenomenon determined by the collective forces of social interaction. It is continually and systematically speeding up relative to objective, astronomical time. We live our lives on the metaphorical, accelerating socio-economic treadmill. A major innovation that might have taken hundreds of years to evolve 1,000 or more years ago may now take only 30 years. Soon it will have to take 25, then 20, then 17, and so on, and, like Sisyphus, we are destined to go on doing it, if we insist on continually growing and expanding. The resulting sequence of singularities, each of which threatens stagnation and collapse, will continue to pile up, leading to what mathematicians call an essential singularity, a sort of mother of all singularities. The great John von Neumann, mathematician, physicist, computer scientist and polymath, a man whose ideas and accomplishments have had a huge influence on your life, made the following remarkably prescient observation more than 70 years ago. The ever-accelerating progress of technology and changes in the mode of human life gives the appearance of approaching some essential singularity in the history of the race, beyond which human affairs, as we know them, could not continue. Among von Neumann's many accomplishments before he died at the relatively young age of 53 in 1957 are his seminal role in the early development of quantum mechanics, his invention of game theory, which is a major tool in economic modeling, and the conceptual design of modern computers, universally referred to as the von Neumann architecture. So, can we imagine making an innovation as powerful and influential as the invention of the Internet every 15, 10, or even 5 years? This is a classic reductio ad absurdum argument showing that, regardless of how ingenious we are, how many marvelous gadgets and devices we invent, we simply won't be able to overcome the threat of the ultimate singularity if we continue business as usual. Estimates from the theory suggest that we are due for another paradigm shift within the next 20 to 30 years' time. This is a little shorter than the estimates from fits to data by Johansson and Sornet, who suggest a number more like 35 years. The theory cannot, of course, tell us the nature of the change, so we can only make wild speculations as to its nature. It could be something as relatively mundane as driverless cars and associated smart devices, or something as dramatic as the kind of science fiction fantasy of Kurzweil and the Singularists. Most likely, it's none of the above, and if we are able to make the paradigm shift, it'll be something totally unexpected. Perhaps more likely is that we can't make the shift, and that we will need to come to terms with the whole concept of open-ended growth and find some new way of defining progress, or be content with what we've got and spend our energies raising the entire planet's standard of living to reflect a comparably high quality of life. Now, that would be a truly major paradigm shift. Continuous growth and the consequent ever-increasing acceleration of the pace of life have profound consequences for the entire planet, and in particular, for cities, socio-economic life, and the process of global urbanization. Until recent times, the time between major innovations far exceeded the productive lifespan of a human being. Even in my own lifetime, it was unconsciously assumed that one would continue working in the same occupation, using the same expertise throughout one's life. This is no longer true. A typical human being now lives significantly longer than the time between major innovations, especially in developing and developed countries. Nowadays, young people entering the workforce can expect to see several major changes during their lifetime that will very likely disrupt the continuity of their careers. This increasingly rapid rate of change induces serious stress on all facets of urban life. This is surely not sustainable, and if nothing changes, we are heading for a major crash and a potential collapse of the entire socio-economic fabric. The challenges are clear. Can we return to an analog of a more ecological phase from which we evolved and be satisfied with some version of sublinear scaling and its attendant natural limiting or no growth stable configuration. Is this even possible? Can we have the kind of vibrant, innovative, creative society driven by ideas and wealth creation as manifested by the best of our world's cities and social organizations? Or are we destined to a planet of urban slums and the ultimate specter of devastation raised by Cormac McCarthy's novel, The Road? Given the special, unique role of cities as the originators of many of our present problems, and their continuing role as the super-exponential driver toward potential disaster, understanding their dynamics, growth, and evolution in a scientifically predictable, quantitative framework is crucial to achieving long-term sustainability on the planet. Perhaps of even greater importance for the immediate future is to develop such a theory within the context of a grand, unified theory of sustainability, by bringing together the multiple studies, simulations, databases, models, theories, and speculations concerning global warming, the environment, financial markets, risk, economies, healthcare, social conflict, and the myriad other characteristics of man as a social being interacting with his environment. Afterword. 1. Signs for the 21st century. From the outset, I have emphasized that the underlying philosophical framework that has guided many of the arguments presented in this audiobook is based on a paradigm inspired by a physics perspective. Consequently, a major theme has been to explore the extent to which a quantitative predictive understanding, based on underlying generic principles that transcend the details of any particular system, can be developed. A fundamental tenet of science is that the world around us is ultimately governed by universal principles, and it is in this context that scaling laws for highly complex systems, such as organisms, cities, or companies, should be viewed. As I have tried to demonstrate, scaling laws reflect systematic regularities that reveal underlying geometric and dynamical behaviors, suggesting that a possible quantitative science of such systems might be attainable. At the very least, they allow us to explore just how far such a paradigm can be pushed. The quest for grand syntheses, for commonalities, regularities, ideas, and concepts that transcend the narrow confines of specific problems or disciplines, is one of the great inspirational drivers of science and scientists. Arguably, it is also a defining characteristic of Homo sapiens, manifested in our multitudinous creeds, religions, and mythologies that help us come to terms with the awesome mysteries of the universe. This search for synthesis and unification has been a major theme in science since its origins in early Greek thinking, which introduced concepts such as atoms and elements as fundamental building blocks from which everything else is constructed. Among the classic grand syntheses in modern science are Newton's laws, which taught us that heavenly laws are no different from those on Earth, Maxwell's unification of electricity and magnetism, which brought the ephemeral ether into our lives and gave us electromagnetic waves, Darwin's theory of natural selection, which reminded us that we're just animals and plants after all, and the laws of thermodynamics, which suggest that we can't go on forever. Each of these has had profound consequences, not only in changing the way we think about the world, but also in laying the foundations for technological advancements that have led to the standard of living many of us are privileged to enjoy. Nevertheless, they are all to varying degrees incomplete. Indeed, understanding the boundaries of their applicability, the limits to their predictive power, and the ongoing search for exceptions, violations, and failures have provoked even deeper questions and challenges, stimulating the continued progress of science and the unfolding of new ideas, techniques, and concepts. One of the great ongoing scientific challenges that has dominated modern physics is the search for a grand unified theory of the elementary particles and their interactions, including its extension to understanding the cosmos and even the origin of space-time itself. Such an ambitious theory would be conceptually based on a parsimonious set of underlying mathematizable universal principles that integrate and explain all of the fundamental forces of nature, from gravity and electromagnetism to the weak and strong nuclear forces, incorporating Newton's laws, quantum mechanics, and Einstein's general theory of relativity. Fundamental quantities like the speed of light, the four dimensions of space-time, and the masses of all of the elementary particles would all be explained, and the equations governing the origin and evolution of the universe through to the formation of galaxies and down to the planetary level, including life itself, would be derived. It is a truly remarkable and enormously ambitious quest that has occupied thousands of researchers for almost 100 years at a cost of billions of dollars. Measured by almost any metric, this ongoing quest, which is still far from its ultimate goal, has been enormously successful, leading, for example, to the discovery of quarks as the fundamental building blocks of matter, the Higgs particle as the origin of mass in the universe, and to black holes and the Big Bang, and to many Nobel Prizes. Emboldened by its great success, physicists endowed this fantastic vision with the grand title of the Theory of Everything, demanding mathematical consistency between quantum mechanics and general relativity, suggested that the basic building blocks of this universal theory might be microscopic vibrating strings, rather than the traditional elementary point particles upon which Newton and all subsequent theoretical developments were based. Consequently, this vision took on the more prosaic subtitle, string theory. Like the invention of gods and God, the concept of a theory of everything connotes the grandest vision of all, the inspiration of all inspirations, namely that we can encapsulate and understand the entirety of the universe in a small set of precepts. In this case, a concise set of mathematical equations from which literally everything follows. Like the concept of God, however, it is potentially misleading and intellectually dangerous. Referring somewhat hyperbolically to a field of study as the theory of everything connotes a certain degree of intellectual arrogance. Is it really conceivable that there is a master equation that encapsulates everything about the universe? Everything? Where's life? Where are animals and cells, brains and consciousness, cities and corporations, love and hate, your mortgage payments, this year's presidential elections, etc.? How, in fact, does the extraordinary diversity, complexity, and messiness that we all participate in here on Earth arise? The simplistic answer is that these are inevitable outcomes of the interactions and dynamics encapsulated in this grand theory of everything. Even time itself is presumed to have emerged from the geometry and dynamics of these vibrating strings. Following the Big Bang, the universe expanded and cooled, and this resulted in the sequential hierarchy from quarks to nucleons, thence to atoms and molecules, and ultimately to the complexity of cells, brains and emotions, and all the rest of life and the cosmos to come tumbling out, a sort of deus ex machina. All of this metaphorically as a consequence of turning the crank of increasingly complicated equations and computations presumed, at least in principle, to be soluble to any sufficient degree of accuracy. Qualitatively, this extreme version of reductionism may indeed have some partial validity, though I'm not sure to what extent anyone actually believes it. But in any case, something is missing. The something includes many of the concepts and ideas implicit in a lot of the problems and questions considered in this audiobook. Concepts like information, emergence, accidents, historical contingency, adaptation, and selection, all characteristics of complex adaptive systems, whether organisms, societies, ecosystems, or economies. These are composed of myriad individual constituents or agents that take on collective characteristics that are generally unpredictable in detail from their underlying components, even if the dynamics of their interactions are known. Unlike the Newtonian paradigm upon which the theory of everything is based, the complete dynamics and structure of complex adaptive systems cannot be encoded in a small number of equations. Indeed, in most cases, probably not even in an infinite number. Furthermore, predictions to arbitrary degrees of accuracy are not possible, even in principle. On the other hand, as I have tried to show throughout the audiobook, scaling theory provides a powerful tool for forging a middle ground in which a quantitative framework can be developed for understanding and predicting the coarse-grained behavior of many broad aspects of such systems. Perhaps then, the most surprising consequence of a visionary theory of everything is that it implies that on the grand scale, the universe, including its origins and evolution, though extremely complicated, is not complex, but in fact is surprisingly simple, because it can be encoded in a limited number of equations, conceivably even just a single master equation. This is in stark contrast to the situation here on Earth, where we are integral to some of the most diverse, complex, and messy phenomena that occur anywhere in the universe, and which require additional, possibly non-mathematizable concepts to understand. So, while applauding and admiring the search for a grand unified theory of all the basic forces of nature, we should recognize that it cannot literally explain and predict everything. Consequently, in parallel with the quest for the theory of everything, we need to embark on a similar quest for a grand unified theory of complexity. The challenge of developing a quantitative, analytic, principled, predictive framework for understanding complex adaptive systems is surely one of the grand challenges for 21st century science. As a vital corollary to this, and of greater urgency, is the need to develop a grand unified theory of sustainability in order to come to terms with the extraordinary threats we now face. Like all grand syntheses, these will almost certainly remain incomplete, and very likely unattainable. But they will nevertheless inspire significant, possibly revolutionary, new ideas, concepts, and techniques, with implications for how we move forward, and whether what we have thus far achieved can survive. 2. Transdisciplinarity, Complex Systems, and the Santa Fe Institute. Although such a vision may not be explicitly articulated in such grandiose terms, it does encapsulate what the Santa Fe Institute was founded to address. It's a remarkable place. Maybe not everybody's cup of tea, but for many of us who still harbor a naive, possibly romantic image of wanting to be part of an eclectic community of scholars searching for truth and beauty, and having been disappointed that we didn't find it in a classic university setting, SFI comes the nearest we're likely to get to realizing it. I feel extraordinarily fortunate and privileged to have been able to spend a number of very productive years in such a marvelous place, stimulated by like-minded colleagues from every possible corner of academia. The ambience and character of SFI are perhaps best captured by the British science writer John Whitfield, who in 2007 wrote, "The Institute was intended to be truly multidisciplinary. It has no departments, only researchers. Santa Fe and complexity theory have become almost synonymous. The Institute, now situated on a hill on the town's outskirts, must be one of the most fun places to be a scientist. The researchers' offices, and the communal areas they spill into for lunch and impromptu seminars have picture windows looking out across the mountains and desert. Hiking trails lead out of the car park. In the Institute's kitchen, you can eavesdrop on a conversation between a paleontologist, an expert on quantum computing, and a physicist who works on financial markets. A cat and dog amble down the corridors, in and out of the offices. The atmosphere is like a cross between the senior common room of a Cambridge college and one of the West Coast temples of geekdom, such as Google or Pixar. I think that Whitfield really got this singular combination of characteristics right. On the one hand, the ivory tower image of an Oxford or Cambridge college, a community of scholars devoted to the pursuit of knowledge and understanding for its own sake by following their proverbial noses wherever it might take them. On the other, the cutting-edge image of Silicon Valley grappling with problems of the real world, seeking innovative solutions and new ways of tackling the complexities of life. Although SFI is a classic basic research institute, in that it is not driven by programmatic or applied agendas, the very nature of the problems it addresses necessarily bring many of us face to face with major societal issues. As a consequence, in addition to its academic network of scholars, the Institute also has a very active business network, called the Applied Complexity Network, comprising diverse companies, some small and incipient, but many of them large and well-known corporations spanning the spectrum of business activities. SFI occupies a unique place in the academic landscape. Its mission is to address fundamental problems and big questions across all scales, at the cutting edge of science, with a bias toward quantitative, analytic, mathematical, and computational thinking. There are no departments or formal groups, but rather a culture dedicated to facilitating long-term, creative, transdisciplinary research across all fields, ranging from the mathematical, physical, and biomedical sciences to the social and economic. It has a small resident faculty, but no tenure, and about 100 external faculty.